Hello, science enthusiasts. Welcome to the Science Podcast. This is episode 13 of season 1. I'm your host, Jason Zukowski. I'm a high school chemistry teacher. I live, breathe, and eat science. Well, I don't eat science. And Bunsen, the Twitter science dog, is our family doggo. What started as a fun way to share pictures of him has turned into this whole social media thing where Bunsen is one of the biggest voices on dog Twitter. Dog Twitter is so wholesome and so uplifting. We're excited to bring a little piece of it to a new format, podcasting. If you want to follow Bunsen, he's at bunsenburner.bmd on Instagram and Facebook, bunsenburnerbmd on Twitter. We also have a Patreon set up, which helps cover the costs of running the podcast. We couldn't do what we do without our patrons on Patreon. Think about signing up if you like Bunsen content at patreon.com/bunsenburner. This week's show is all about science communication. We have a really fun guest who's from Scotland, Sam Langford, and he's a science communicator himself. We're going to have some fun trivia about science, and in dog science, we're going to be taking a look at some new information that came out about the monstrous Tibetan Mastiffs. It's very cool. Well, we might as well get right to the show, because if we're going to be communicating about science, we better start that communication. Okay, Bunsen. Yeah, we'll get right to it. There's no time like science time. Okay, this week in science news, it's going to be more of a little bit of science history. Since this podcast episode is all about science communication, I thought I would tell you something that's near and dear to my heart, and maybe why, if you follow Bunsen, he posts so much about vaccine and vaccine safety and getting immunized. It's hard to believe, but 50 years ago to the day that I'm recording this podcast, September 13th, the last case of polio was still occurring in the United States. So that's 1969, the last case of polio occurred in the United States. And polio before that time, especially about a decade before that, was this horrific disease in Canada that affected thousands and thousands of people. 11,000 people, not 1,000, but 11,000 people were left paralyzed in Canada between 1949 and 1954. Now, why does polio have a connection to my family? Well, here it is, and it's a really personal story, because my grandma Marion, on the Zukowski side, my dad's mom, got polio in 1955, the same year the Salk vaccine became available. She contracted polio in Lloydminster, Alberta, Canada, and there was a couple other women, my dad says, got polio too, and it left her paralyzed. So my dad, Rob, and his younger brothers, Gene, Murray, and Phil, all then had a mother who was paralyzed. I only knew my grandma Marion when she was in a wheelchair. So polio definitely affected my family long after it was considered eradicated in the world. And it's hard to believe that 50 years ago, there was still polio on the earth. And it's hard to believe that the whole world came together and eradicated polio with vaccinations. And the vaccines for polio back then were not near as safe as the vaccines that are today. It took a bit longer to certify Canada as being polio free because of our unurbanized areas. There's a lot of places in Canada that is only accessible by really airplane or by boat. And Canada was only considered polio free in 1994. Now, that's our recent past. There were still polio cases in 1993 in Canada. So what did this change with my dad's family's life? Well, My grandmother didn't have to go into an iron lung. An iron lung was something that was used for people who had polio, and it affected their lungs and it helped regulate their breathing. The iron lung use was usually around 1930, but it continued through the peak of polio in Canada in the 50s and the late 50s. My grandmother lost the use of her legs. She had to be in a wheelchair, and then she had severe post-polio syndrome and symptoms 40 years later. So in the last decade of her life before she died, she suffered from post-polio syndrome or symptoms. And it's like you're getting hit again. You're unlucky enough to get polio the first time, and then in the last few years of your life, you start to lose whatever movement that you were left with. She couldn't move her arms. She couldn't bend her wrists. She couldn't close her fingers. The other thing that struck me as particularly cruel about polio was that while she couldn't move her legs, she still felt pain in them, and they were hypersensitive. And that's another side effect of polio. So her legs were very, very sensitive. And if you bumped them, I just remember as a kid, if you ever bumped her legs, like, she would wince in pain because it actually caused her quite a bit of pain. My dad's life was really different back then. He had to turn from a teenager into a caregiver because his father had to work to provide for the family for their family. Now that my grandmother, his mom, couldn't walk. She was a school teacher, and she could no longer be a school teacher after that, after polio. Nothing in the 50s and 60s and 70s really was wheelchair accessible. Think of all the wheelchair accessible stuff that we have today. There's wheelchair parking. There's wheelchair ramps. There was nothing, absolutely nothing back then. My dad has a couple, he likes to talk about it sometimes, but I think some of the memories are kind of painful for him. One story that he talks about is the dentist. They had to go to the dentist, and the dentist was two flights up stairs. There's no elevator. There's no ramp. If their mom had to get to the dentist, they had to carry her. So here's my dad, you know, 13, 14 years old, and his brothers having to haul their mom up these stairs to go to the dentist. And that's just one thing. Now there's some funny stories too. So I'll share you some of their funny stories, which are, they're kind of terrible in context. Now you might think they're really bad kids. And I think they were just normal kids that maybe weren't supervised as much as they should have been. But my dad and his brothers, my uncles, were troublemakers. So not like criminals, but definitely troublemakers. And they would get into trouble doing whatever. And they would get in big trouble from my grandmother. So the story goes, and I totally believe it. One time they stepped over the line. Who knows? Maybe they broke a window. They were big into sports. They were playing baseball or something. Who knows what it was? But they stepped over a line, and it was time for them to get in trouble. So they hid on the other side of the only bed in their house that my grandmother couldn't get to in her wheelchair. So they knew they were in trouble, and they were safe in this corner. So you can imagine like a bunch of like boys huddled in a corner with a seething, angry mom in a wheelchair who can't quite get to them because of how the room is situated and how the bed is situated. And they would have to, and then she was like, "You just wait till your dad gets home." And yeah, I think they got a little bit of a whooping when their dad got home. Another time they were in big trouble outside, who knows what they were doing. The stories change depending on which uncle or my dad is telling the story. And they were in trouble. So to get away from my grandmother, they thought quickly, used a little bit of engineering skills, and put sticks, long sticks, in the spokes of her wheelchair so she couldn't roll after them, and they escaped. That, of course, made their punishment way worse the next day. And they have a lot of these, a couple of these funny stories of, you know, not being supervised because their mom couldn't follow them everywhere. So it lightens some of the sadness and the tragedy of the situation. So why is this science news? Well, one of the big reasons is that there's a small group of people in the world. They're very vocal, and they have been taught, they have learned, they have listened to bad science. That started with Andrew Wakefield's failed and debunked terrible study that linked autism to vaccination rates. I'm not saying that all vaccines are 100% safe. That's not true. A fraction, a very small fraction, so small, in fact, it's very difficult to get data on it, of people do have serious adverse reactions to vaccines, but the overwhelming majority don't. And vaccines do not cause autism. Even though that still persists to that this day, there is no evidence, zero evidence that vaccines cause autism. But because of that, because of the misinformation from this small but vocal group of people who have been misinformed and misled, you see pockets of disease coming back all over the world. Measles in New York City, measles in Disneyland or Disney World, Alberta, Canada. In southern Alberta, we had a whooping cough epidemic that was really frightening because the vaccination rates had fallen, if you can believe it, so low in some areas, it's less than 50%. So this is science news because really 50 years ago is within the lifespan of a lot of people who were still alive. People, the baby boomers, for example, if there's any baby boomers listening to this, you were alive when polio was a thing or it just stopped being a thing. And my dad is in his 60s and his family was affected by it. So I thought that was just important to bring up in science news, that there are diseases around the world. Polio was this catastrophic paralytic disease that killed people and maimed people and paralyzed people for life. The world came together and with good science and good organizational skills, basically eliminated polio from the planet. There's still pockets of it, but it's mostly all gone. The same could happen to a certain extent, maybe not complete eradication, but the same could be done to most of the other communicable diseases that we have today. We don't see them. People don't get them, but they are starting to again if we don't vaccinate, if we don't maintain herd immunity. So that's just my soapbox. That's why Bunsen tweets so much about vaccines and getting vaccinated. It has a personal connection to our family. All of the Zukowski family knows what it's like to have a family member affected by a disease that there at the time the vaccine wasn't available. Everybody I'm living today, my kids, will never get polio. It's gone. We don't have to think about it. But there's other diseases that maybe we do. That's why everybody needs to work together to get vaccinated. And that's science news for this week. Okay, I love this story this week in dog science. And this came out only a couple days ago. The story in dog science this week is about the Tibetan Mastiffs. Now, I think Bunsen's big. He's actually on the small side for Bernese Mountain Dogs. Originally, I think maybe I was a little sad that he wasn't going to be this big, monstrous dog. You might have heard in the mailbag last time, I was trying to work on Chris after our Golden died and we went through the grieving process and we were looking at getting a new dog. I really, really loved the Newfoundlander dog. I've seen them before. They're just like these giant, huge, fluffy, goofball things. And when we went to see them, they're enormous. Like I'm talking hundreds of pounds these things are. They're huge. One, we saw one that was the dad of a litter. And when he was standing up, he was taller than me. I'm a big guy. I'm 6'3". And this dog, when it was standing up, was taller than me. Tibetan Mastiffs aren't quite as big as a Newfoundlander, but they seriously dwarf Bunsen. Bunsen's just shy of 100 pounds, and he's a big guy. Like when Chris or Adam are lying down with him, he's as big as they are. Like he dwarfs other dogs. But Tibetan Mastiffs are big. They're at least 150 pounds. They're really fluffy like Bunsen. The reason why we're talking about them in science news this week is some genealogy and scientific research came back about their history. And their history is really interesting. Tibetan Mastiffs have got special genes in their body to have a greater lung capacity. And that lung capacity, the researchers believe, comes from an extra bit of wolf inside. So this paper was published this summer in Molecular Biology and Evolution. And what they claim and what the research claims is that at some point in the past, some dogs around that area interbred with enormous Tibetan wolves. And then the descendants of that pair over time, the descendants of the dogs in that area and the Tibetan wolf became the Tibetan Mastiff. And the Tibetan Mastiff has a special, it's got a mutation for these amino acids. They're like, amino acids are little tiny pieces of proteins that make the Tibetan Mastiff's blood better at absorbing and releasing oxygen. Well, why is that important? Why would that be a good thing for a wolf? Like, if they got that mutation from a wolf, or why would you want that in the dog? It's the same reason why our elite athletes train in high elevations. The more oxygen your body can carry, and our elite athletes do that, they train at very high elevations where there is less oxygen. So in order to do whatever they're doing, their body has to work a little bit harder. And usually they produce more red blood cells. So when they come down to a lower elevation, their body can absorb more oxygen. That's the reason why these wolves had a huge advantage. These wolves were able to absorb more oxygen and keep it inside their blood for longer. So having more oxygen in your blood gave you an extreme advantage over all the other critters at that elevation, because you didn't tire as easily, you could hunt faster, you could hunt better, you could run further. Brilliant! Now, you may not know this, but I find this really interesting, but this mutation is only in Tibetan Mastiffs. That's it. It's not in Bernese Mountain Dogs, even though Bernese Mountain Dogs were bred in the mountains, the Bern region of Switzerland. And we'll talk about the history of Bernese Mountain Dogs in another podcast, I think. But these two little, remember they had mutations for two amino acids, these two little blips allows them to produce hemoglobin, which binds oxygen. Remember, hemoglobin is found within the red blood cells, and it binds oxygen to hemoglobin much better. Domestic dogs don't have this. So these Tibetan Mastiff dogs are like superheroes at high elevations. Remember, the higher you go, one of the problems that everybody runs into, humans or animals, is there's less oxygen. And when there's less oxygen, you can't do as much. You get lightheaded. You can't go as far. I've been mountain climbing a few times, and you definitely feel it once you hit kind of like where scree starts on the mountain. You don't have the same kind of vegetation. There's not enough oxygen for it up there. And you do get lightheaded. So the genetic studies have shown that the Tibetan wolves had this mutation. It was within their DNA code. And that genetic mutation for high altitude survivability was passed to the fluffy and stoic Tibetan Mastiffs. I think that's really cool. Every dog breed has like a unique specialty that it was bred for. Something that it's really, really good at. The reason why we selected them. The more you learn about dogs, the more fascinating they are as these creatures. Because there's so many different types of them. And they're all so good at, like, they have hidden talents. I didn't even know about this about the Tibetan Mastiff. Maybe there's some people listening who have one of those giant dogs, those Tibetan Mastiffs. Maybe you didn't even know that. I didn't know when we had our Golden, that we had Callan. She had, Golden Retrievers have webbed feet. I had no idea that they had webbed feet like a duck, but it's because they were bred to be swimmers. The Newfoundlanders I was talking about, they have webbed feet too. Bunsen, and when we talk about the Bernese Mountain Dog, Bunsen has a completely different bone structure to any other dog breed, really. His front, like his, the front of him is just bony and beefy as heck because they were built to pull carts. So when he doesn't like to jump, he doesn't like to stand on his back legs. He likes to plant. That's his superpower. The Tibetan Mastiff superpower, they can survive at higher elevations than any other dog because way in the past, either forced by humans or by their own choice, they got jiggy with some Tibetan wolves. And that's dog science for this week. We're going to take a break right now and talk to you about one of the sponsors of the podcast, PLAY, or petplay.com. They sent Bunsen, and there's pictures of it on social media, an adorable beaker tug-of-war rope. He just loves it. They squeak. We've been playing with him quite a bit with these little beaker toys. Adam, what's Play?
Play is a small business in San Francisco, California, with a mission to make things better, not only for people, but the planet as well. Not only do their products truly meet the needs of modern pet parents, but they also give back to shelters and worldwide wildlife initiatives.
How much plastic do they recycle in some of their products?
They've saved over 4 million bottles from entering the landfills.
What? 4 million bottles? That's crazy. That's so good for the environment. Hey, I think they sent us a code to use at petplay.com. What's the code, Adam?
It's Bunsen15 for a 15% discount off anything.
15% discount at petplay.com. We're really excited to have Play as our sponsor. Their tenets fit with Bunsen's motto and they're environmentally sound. Check them out at petplay.com and use Bunsen15. On the podcast today, we have Sam Langford, and you are calling in from Glasgow, Scotland. Is that correct?
That is. Hello. How are you doing?
I'm so good. Thank you so much for being a guest on the podcast, being our expert today.
No, my pleasure. Really excited to be involved.
What's your weather like in Scotland right now?
We've actually got some sunshine, which is very, very unusual, and it's quite warm as well. Very, very strange for us to be having such a nice couple of days of weather.
Is it stereotypical to think that it's rainy quite a bit in Scotland, or you guys have quite a bit of precipitation on most days?
So it's probably a stereotype because it's true. It does rain a lot.
One of my wife's favorite shows, and I know it's probably a stereotype, is the Outlander series, just because it shows off how beautiful Scotland can be and the old culture and things like that. Do people in Scotland know, like, is that a big thing in Scotland that the Outlander TV show was filmed there, or are you guys just like, well, that's just happening, oh well?
I think it's got quite a good reputation over here, actually, especially because it's introducing more of the Scots language.
The Gaelic, correct?
There's Gaelic, but there's also Scots as well. So Gaelic is, it doesn't sound anything like the English language, but you've got Scots, yeah, which does sound a little bit like the English language, but some of the words are very strangely pronounced from what you would expect to hear. And it's a bit lesser known, and some of those words do kind of show up in Outlander. So it's nice from that aspect, and it's nice from my point of view, whenever I've watched it, to see some of the discussions about the Jacobites and the different clans and just a little bit more of the history that we're actually not taught a lot about in schools over here. So it's quite nice from that aspect to see that show doing really well, and it's going from strength to strength, and it's really exciting.
That's awesome. Well, I didn't mean to take up our time talking about Outlander. Well, let's chat about you. What is your expert today? What is your what's your science training, or what's your training in SciComm?
So I don't have any formal training in science communication, but science has always been a part of my life. My grandparents used to take me to the zoo all the time when I was a child. We read lots of books about wildlife, and they introduced me to David Attenborough's documentaries. So I knew from a very young age that I wanted to study zoology, and that's what I ended up doing. I studied at the University of Glasgow, which was quite honestly one of the best places to have had the opportunity to study. And as part of my studies, I got the chance to travel to Trinidad and Tobago in the Caribbean on a research trip. And during that time, I got my first taste of science communication, teaching local school kids about the local flora and fauna. And I loved that experience. It was the beginning of what is now the career that I'm doing. So I moved into a role with the Royal Society for the Protection of Birds, and a community fundraising role. So there was a lot of public engagement alongside that. And then I worked for the Scottish Wildlife Trust as a ranger, which did a lot more kind of outdoor work, but also a lot of engaging with the public. So that was, there's a constant theme throughout all of the roles I've had over the past, how many years are we on now? About 7 years. And I then have landed at Glasgow Science Centre. So I started there as a science communicator, which involved delivering science shows, running workshops for schools and families, and just generally being a really enthusiastic advocate for science. And that lasted about 9 months before the current role that I'm in, which is as a science learning coordinator, still within Glasgow Science Centre. And I split my time now mainly between developing the education programme for schools and providing opportunities for academic and industry professionals to engage the public with their work. So no kind of formal experience in training for science communication, but I seem to have just landed here, and it's an amazing place to be, a really exciting place to be.
Those we have science centers here in Canada as well, and that's the one thing. Whenever I've been there with my own kids, or occasionally I've been on field trips with students, or just like I've presented at a few, the excitement that kids have in those centers, you can just like feel it. It's like a buzz in the air. It's so cool, and that must be really rewarding to be a part of that.
Like the thing that I always enjoy the most is when you're speaking to a kid, a little kid or a big kid, aka an adult, and you get to talk to them about a concept within science, and all of a sudden you see a little spark within their eye, and you know that they've understood the concept or they've become excited by the concept, and they might go away and learn something new. And whether that is like one child or a group of kids or even a group of adults, yeah, it's a really rewarding place to be. Really, really do love my job.
That's awesome. Now, can you talk to me about Big Chats? That's in your bio. What is Big Chats?
Big Chats, or BIG as it's known, is the Science Communicators Network in the United Kingdom. It's an organization set up to provide networking opportunities, skills training, and acts as a forum for science communicators across the country. It culminates in a yearly conference, which is a 2.5 day conference in a city somewhere in the UK. This year it was in Edinburgh, where people get together and share ideas or provide training on different aspects of science communicating. And this year, I was lucky enough to be elected to the executive committee. So I'm a general officer on that committee now. So hopefully, I'm going to play a part in taking the organization forward over the next 12 months. So, yeah, it's a new challenge for me, something completely, completely new and completely different, but one that I'm really relishing getting my teeth stuck into.
So you can start to help shape policy and then maybe help people who are new to it getting through some of the pitfalls that maybe you had earlier in your career.
Yeah, that's the hope. Yeah, so using the experience that I've had to try and provide training opportunities for new science communicators, or providing seasoned science communicators the opportunity to deliver that training. So yeah, it's nice to be involved in something that can make a real change within the industry. We'll see how it goes. It should be something very interesting to do.
Well, that's exciting. Congratulations on that. That's amazing.
Thank you very much.
Since this is the science podcast with the pun PAWD, we ask our guests kind of in between in the interview for a story about a pet, dog, cat, or really anything. Do you have a story to share with us about a pet that you've had or a pet you have?
So I actually have a number of different pets at the moment. So I've got a bearded dragon called Xander. He's named after the character from Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And they're meant to be some of the most laid back animals in the world, but we somehow have managed to land with a really angry lizard who will be quite aggressive towards his food and wants to just be left alone. But kind of conversely, alongside that, we've also got a royal python called Archimedes, who is the most laid back animal in the world, and I just love having a snake around. It's an interesting pet to have. Also got a crested gecko, and of course I've got a miniature labradoodle called Penny, who is currently lying fast asleep on the rug just now. So she's one of my best friends. And it's really lovely having so many pets. I've always loved having animals around, and especially now that I'm not directly involved in a role which engages with animals, it's really great to have them as part of my day-to-day life. I think that the dog in particular is someone that, or an animal that really has a really positive impact on my mental health. I think that she helps with anxieties that I have, and when you're not having a great day, she's always really great to have around. There's nothing better in the world than a dog. So, yeah, I love her, and sometimes she forgets that.
Oh, it's very heartwarming. My oldest son, when he was growing up, he had two bearded dragons, and they're definitely a unique kind of creature. It's tough. I'm not a super big fan of reptiles or lizards.
Yeah.
But both of my boys are. My youngest son has a snake, and he likes it. And it is pretty laid back. Like, you can take it out. It doesn't, you know, it's not harmful or dangerous in any way. And it eats rats. It's kind of crazy. They're definitely a different type of thing that you have to care for. And then that, of course, is part of your routine in the day.
So, yeah. They're fairly easygoing, and they can take it or leave it, whether you give them a lot of attention. What kind of snake is it that your son has?
It's an albino. I think it's a corn snake. My wife is in charge of the snake because I'm not a big fan of the thing. So my youngest son and my wife, they're in charge of it. I just go by the rats when they need me to help with that. So
fair enough.
Yeah,
corn
snake. Definitely unique. Like, it's a white snake. Like, it's albino.
Okay, that's really cool.
Yeah, well, they like it, and I know one of the teachers I teach with. He's got a corn snake called Cornflake, and the kids just adore this. it's of course orange. It's Cornflake, the corn snake.
Yeah.
And on top of that, we do a Harry Potter challenge at our school, or I run a Harry Potter challenge, and he's the head of Slytherin. So it makes perfect sense that he's got a snake as a pet. So, yeah, kids really identify sometimes with reptiles and with snakes. So some kids don't identify with the furry pets at all, like cats and dogs. And then they'll get that hook with the reptile or even like insects. So I think pets are just – there's a broad spectrum of pets, and they're important to all of us humans for our mental health.
Yeah.
Being in science communication for a while – is there any area that you think, like, I know you've got a role shaping policy now. Is there any area that science communication should focus on? I noticed, like, I follow your Twitter feed as Bunsen, and it's a very broad, general kind of things that your Twitter feed posts. But is there anything specific we should focus on? Or should science communication be that broad kind of shotgun approach?
For me, I think that scientists and science communicators in general, we have a responsibility to engage with the big questions, whether it is anti-vaccine movement or whether it's to do with climate change. We've seen the wonderful Greta Thunberg has shown just how important it is to engage with these topics. But I also think that in order to actually get people to listen, it's important that they feel like it's relatable to them. And I feel like sometimes that's why these subjects can be quite challenging. So I can see why we've seen the rise of things like fake news or alternative facts in recent years, like the spread of social media and the ease with which false narratives can be thrown onto the internet. And many of these false narratives are really emotive, and they strike at the heart of what people really care about. And I think that that's where science communicators need to do better, creating authentic styles of science communication that engages with their audience lives. Like, knowing your audience is really important. You can't just say climate change is going to kill us all, stop driving your car, or get your measles jab. Some people need their car. Some are genuinely scared of the misinformation out there about vaccinations. So you need to understand the needs and wants of your audience. And if you want to get them to think about how a subject's important, you can't just tell them they're doing something wrong or to blindly trust the graph or the statistics you have. You need to show them why it should be important to them on a level which resonates with their own personal lives. And I think that's why I really enjoy the work that I do at the Glasgow Science Centre. We use an approach that puts learners at the focus of their learning experience. So it's not about throwing facts at them. It's instead focused on trying to get them to facilitate their own learning. I won't get too much into how we actually do that, but it's a learner-centered approach, and it allows them to take control and learn more about the things which are important to them. But then, I suppose at the end of the day, no one aspect of science is more important than any other. So I wouldn't ever want to focus on one particular aspect of science communication. Like there's always room for some really cool experiment which gets an 8-year-old thinking, well, why did that happen? And hopefully they go on to try and find out why, and whether that is learning about the Newton's laws of motion, or whether it is learning about neutron stars exploding, or whether it is just learning about why we should do a little bit more to help our environment and why that has a benefit for the entire of humanity. So yeah, I think that shotgun approaches are really good, but at the same time it's very valuable for us to look at these more focused approaches that really have an impact on all of us.
I really feel the tide is turning in the last, I want to say like the last 3 or 4 years. I've noticed like a global effort by a younger generation of trained scientists to really focus on science communication. And it's not something that I saw a decade ago. Like there was, I don't even know if it was really a thing or people just did it and they didn't think they were doing science communication. Of course it was still out there, but I want to say like there's been definitely an improvement in the last 3 or 4 years with everybody who has a little bit of public relations skills getting the message out there. And instead, like what you said is so important. It's more of a conversation rather than an authority. Like, hey, let's chat about this instead of like, hey, this is a graph, you better believe it. Part of that I think needs to be in science because of course science is an authority itself. But I like what you said about it being interactive rather than being just kind of like top down.
Yeah, absolutely. It's when you go back to just like the concept of what engagement is, engagement should be a two-way process. So it should never just be about this person in an ivory tower comes down to lecture the people that don't know. So you're right, we're seeing a lot more of it, especially within younger scientists now. Especially I work a lot with PhD students who come into the Science Centre to share their work. And they're very, very, very active in trying to be involved in science communication. And I think there's a changing shift in the mindset that we should be trying to engage more with different public audiences. Also in this country, we're seeing a lot more of it being built into funding applications. So in order to receive funding, then you should also be building in an element of public engagement as part of a project. So I think that there's a mindset that we should do that, it's important, but also on the funder side, there's also being seen that it's important, so therefore you kind of have to do it, which has its positives and it has its negatives, but it's definitely a start. So yeah, I think you're absolutely right that we are seeing a shift in people putting more of an importance on engaging with public audiences.
Yeah, for me, it's really heartwarming. Like I'm a high school chemistry teacher. So within my class, I have a huge impact. But when the kids go home, if they're reading articles or if they're just watching TV, there can be some really one-sided information out there. And in the past, like I would say like a decade ago, in North America, you had like one person as the main big science communicator. And that was Bill Nye, the science guy, like 10, 15 years ago. It was just one guy. He had a show. He sometimes was on the news and whatever he was saying, sometimes they would have a different person that would disagree with him, like especially with climate change. But now when you are looking at the generation that's coming up, it's like a team effort. Everybody is like, okay, well, that's not my specialty, but let's have a discussion as to why the science makes sense. Instead of just one person versus one, there's many voices now in some of the big areas, which I think is really cool.
Yeah. How would you see it in North America in terms of so big names who are involved in science communication? Do they tend to still be white men? Obviously there's Neil deGrasse Tyson, but you've got Bill Nye, you have Steve Spangler, you have individuals like that, and they tend to be white men. Is there a movement to try and include more diverse voices in science communication?
See, I'm not in that realm to know who's hiring who.
Yeah.
I know like Canada is a little different than the United States. We have a CBC, which is like the country's broadcasting company. There's some programs that run with some female voices on it. In TV, like if you're just to click on the TV, I still think there's some diversity problems. What's happening on social media, I'm finding is that there's less of a diversity problem on social media with people getting the information out. And I think that that diversity on social media will hopefully be reflected in reality. I know at our school, in my department, the science department, we have an equal amount of male and female teachers. So that's really good for the kids to see, especially as they're going into adulthood, that all of these experts, you know, they're not all men, they're not all women, they're a mix. But I think you're right, like the big name ones are still white men.
No, it's okay. I was just gonna say it is kind of the same over here, that we still have broadly a lot of men who are the voices. But we're encouraging to see the Royal Institution, who provide Christmas lectures every year, and which are televised on the BBC. This year and last year have been hosted by women, which is great, and we're seeing more voices come through from not just women but also non-white science communicators as well, which is fantastic to see. There is obviously still a bias towards white science communicators and predominantly white men, but I think we're seeing a good shift, or at least a good will to shift it in that direction, which is really nice. But when it comes to kind of on the ground science communication, for example, I think quite a lot of our science communicators are female. At the kind of lower end of the scale, we have a lot of female presenters. And then as you work your way up, you see that stereotypical, they all become men again as the men move up into those higher paying jobs with more responsibility, which is still sad to see. But I think we're seeing improvements, and it's step by step, slowly but surely, we're getting there to try and get more diverse voices, not just presenting, but also becoming the decision makers. And it can only benefit everyone by having a more diverse group of voices in the room. So hopefully on my side of the Atlantic we see more improvement on it.
I'll just give a shout out. The first guest on my podcast was a teacher I taught with. She's retired now. She was the most amazing person I ever taught with, Kim Burley. So I know for a fact that she influenced hundreds of maybe thousands of young girls to go into science. So like you said, it can only help out everybody when many voices are heard. And that's such a good point.
Teachers just can have such a massive impact, and they never get the recognition that they deserve for the work that they do, and the number of kids that they see every single year, and the way that they can have such a massive impact on them. So yeah, shout out to all teachers.
You betcha. Shout out to all teachers. Yeah, as we're going back to school, our system in Canada and Alberta starts up in the first week of September. So, yeah, so that's everybody's getting ready to go back to school in Alberta, Canada.
Looking forward to it.
Sorry?
Are you looking forward to going back?
Oh, I love my job. I'm super lucky to have found a career that, you know, I do look forward to every day going to work. It's not something that's a drudgery or it's annoying. It's a tough job. It's a hard job. You know, being in front of an audience, you have to be on at 100%. So unless you're in teaching or unless you're in presenting, it's kind of an alien world to people who don't understand that. I'm not saying it's harder than any other job. It's just it's a very rewarding but tough career for sure. So one of the things I was going to ask you, being is that you presented science for a while and you have some background training in zoology, and we actually asked this of everybody, and it's the super fact. Do you have a piece of knowledge that when you tell people, they kind of like go, wow, that's crazy. Something that would blow somebody's mind.
Yeah. So it's not related to zoology. The one that I always love is that right now, sitting in Glasgow, Scotland, I'm currently closer to space than I am to Dundee, which is a city in the east coast of Scotland, which I can drive there fairly quickly, but I'm still closer to space than I am to that city, which is always fantastic to think about. And blows people's minds whenever you tell them that.
Right. I've heard that before, but I've never really, that's cool that you brought that up. I know I've heard that before. Like if you could just turn your car at a 90 degree angle and drive straight up.
Yeah. It's always one that really blows people's minds. It's only about 100 kilometers or 62 miles, I think it is, straight up. So yeah. So if you were, about 2 hours, maybe, if you were driving about 50, 60 kilometers.
Do you find when you talk about space with kids, it's or even big kids, like adults, do you find that's an area that really hooks kids because it's so big and so fantastical?
Yeah, the two subjects that I know that regardless of which kid or which big kid it is that always hook people in are space and dinosaurs. Those are the two. This summer, we have been running a large-scale program on the 50th anniversary of the moon landing. And we do a lot of space-related engagement. We have Scotland's largest full-dome digital planetarium, so we're well-versed in it, and we know that people enjoy it. But the response that we've had to talking about the momentous occasion of going to the moon back in the 1960s, 1970s, it was unprecedented just how many people have been interested and just wanted to talk to us for hours about how we managed that incredible feat. So yeah, space is always a great subject because there's so much to talk
about. I know. It's one in our grade 9 curriculum in Alberta, that is the last time that kids in Alberta get to learn and talk about space as a specific subject. And then it goes away. You learn a little bit in advanced physics, like in planetary motion and gravitational pull and things like that. So that's one of the things that when I get to teach Science 9, occasionally, sometimes I don't. I love that unit just because you can just explain the magnitude and the scale of space. And the kids just, sometimes it's the first time they've ever had to think about how big a sun is compared to the Earth, and that's just one fact, and they're just like, what?
Whenever I periodically go and I watch our presenters in our planetarium talk about the beginnings of the universe, or the scale of our star, the sun, versus the scale of even bigger stars, and it makes you feel incredibly small and insignificant. But it's just incredible to think about, we are this tiny little speck in amongst an unending universe that is too big to even think about. So yeah, it always blows your mind, even if you're 5 years old or if you're 55 years old. Space is great.
It is great. I had a really touching conversation with my grandfather about 5 years ago. He's quite elderly. I was driving him to a doctor's appointment. And he knew I teach science and chemistry. And then I don't know why he asked me, maybe he was just curious, but he asked me about the sun. And because he didn't graduate, because he's from the generation, the farm family generation in Canada, like the old school one where the boys dropped out of school in like grade 7 or 8 and went to work on the farm. He had absolutely no idea what the sun was made of or how big it was. And after I talked to him for like 10 minutes, he couldn't believe it. Like, he was this elderly man and he had lived his whole life not knowing the sun was not on fire and it was a million times bigger than the Earth. And that, I think that's the power of science communication, is maybe we take for granted what we know when we take for granted that we know these things when lots of people have gaps in their knowledge, and it's important for us to fill that in.
Yeah, absolutely. It's something that anyone who talks about science should always remember what it was like to not know something and then to find it out, because then you always retain that kind of sense of wonder, even if it's your millionth time explaining a concept. If you know that you're explaining it to someone who's never heard that before, then you can blow their mind. And I think what you're saying as well about your grandfather finding out a new fact about the sun when he's in his elder years, is that you can be curious no matter what age you are, and there's always room for learning. So that's a really heartwarming story to hear. Thank you for that.
No problem, Sam. So we're getting to the end of the interview. Where can people find you on social media?
So you can follow me at Scottish SciComm on Twitter. I tend to talk about I'll talk about science, obviously. I'll also talk a little bit about politics, dogs, food in Glasgow. So please do follow me. And I'll also give a shout out to Glasgow Science Centre. So you can follow them on Twitter at GSC1. And you can find out about all the cool things going on over here in Glasgow.
Awesome. So if I was a tourist to Scotland, what are a couple things we should check out? Like if you've never been to Scotland before?
If you've never been, then come to Glasgow, not to Edinburgh. Edinburgh's great, but Glasgow's definitely better. come to Glasgow, see the different world-class museums that we have. So obviously we have Glasgow Science Centre, but we have Kelvin Grove Art Gallery and Museum, which is just an incredible day out. It is completely free. Travel to Loch Lomond, which is about 45 minutes from Glasgow by car, and you can get to see one of the most famous bodies of water in the world. Drive an hour and a half, 2 hours north and get to the Highlands, and you can get to see some of the best landscapes on the planet. And find any whiskey distillery and try some whiskey.
There you go. Thank you for that advice. That's great. I'm sure some people, if they're making travel arrangements, will be pretty pleased about those tips there.
Yeah, no worries. I'll add in at the end, I do actually really like Edinburgh, so I'm not being too scathing about that city.
Oh, it's okay. Canadians joke about if you're not from the province of Manitoba, Canadians sometimes joke about Manitoba. But Manitoba is a beautiful province. So anybody listening from Manitoba, maybe that's where your sarcasm or joke was coming from. Anyways, thank you so much for being a guest on the podcast today, talking about science communication and your pets. Your dog's name is it Jenny?
Penny.
Penny. Oh, Penny. There you go. Very cute. Do you have some pictures of your dogs on social media?
Oh yeah, all the time there'll be pictures of Penny going up there. So she is a lovely miniature Labrador, very photogenic.
Very cute. All right, well, thank you so much again, Sam. I do appreciate you being a guest, and I guess we'll keep working on science communication together.
No problem. Thank you very much for having me. It's been really good fun.
All right, awesome. Take care.
Thank you. Bye bye.
It's time for Woo or Wow. In this section, I will be reading three statements. Two of them will be fake. They will be woo. One of them will be true. It will be a wow. Okay, here we go. The first statement. There has been a device created to harness the night sky and produce electricity. What? That's crazy. Here's the second one. Bulls angrily attack the color red. Okay. Here's the third one. An injured or severed earthworm will grow into two earthworms. All right. So the three statements are, a device has been invented to harness the power of the night sky. The second statement, bulls get angry at the color red. And the third statement, a severed earthworm will regrow itself into two new earthworms. Which one is the false statement? Think. Okay, time's up. All right, let's take a look at the wormy one. That one is woo. Now, earthworms have a head and a tail. So if you chop them in half, they don't grow a new head. Then the head portion will survive sometimes, but the tail part will die. So you don't get multiple earthworms by chopping them up. However, there is a planarian flatworm that can regenerate itself from 1/300th of its original pieces. So if you chop off a little piece of this little planarian, it may regrow itself, which is crazy. Earthworms don't. Okay, that leaves two statements. One is woo, the other is true. The woo statement is bulls getting angry at the color red. They don't. Scientists think that bulls and other cows are probably mostly colorblind, so they can't even see the color red. The reason why bulls, you know, historically are shown getting mad at a matador or somebody wearing the color red is they're just mad at the matador because he's being a jerk. He's taunting them. So it doesn't matter what he's wearing. The guy, the person, the matador could be wearing a sparkly white costume And as long as he was being a jerk to the bull would get upset. I don't think you can blame a bull for attacking a matador. I mean, they're being jerks to these bulls. Okay, that leaves the last statement as being the device that can harness the night sky. And that's true. Now, it doesn't produce a lot of power, but within it, it contains a thermoelectric generator. The sky-facing side of this thermoelectric generator absorbs infrared radiation. That's crazy, but infrared radiation doesn't require visible light. It's around us all the time, just like microwave radiation coming from your microwave or radio waves which come from your cell phone. They're all electromagnetic radiation. So this device just has to point to the sky and it gets a little bit of power. Now, it's not producing an incredible amount of power, but it does produce a little bit of power, enough to light a little light bulb. Aw. But hey, that's something. And that's woo or wow.
It's that time again. It's time for the mailbag with me, Adam. Okay, so the first question comes from a poll on Twitter. All right, so it is, do students like Bunsen? Dad, because you're a teacher, do your students like Bunsen?
Yeah, they love Bunsen. From when he was a puppy and I showed them some puppy pictures and I brought him in, there's a lot of students at my school that just adore Bunsen. And he was a little scared of getting mobbed by people when he was younger. He's a lot better now. And he comes in during exam time and helps with kids' anxiety around tests. And they come see him, and he's so good, and he lays down, and he likes getting belly rubs, and he's really easy to pose. So one of the things the kids love doing is giving him treats and making him wear, they'll wear their hats, or they'll take like a selfie with him and put that on their social media. So he's a big hit with kids at my school. Do your friends like Bunsen, Adam?
My friends really like Bunsen. They keep on telling me, how does it like to have less followers than your dog? And I'm like, it's fine. You have less followers than him, too.
What about people in your marching band?
They really like Bunsen. They love Bunsen. Everybody just crowds around Bunsen whenever Bunsen's there, and it's great.
Chris, do kids at your school like Bunsen?
Well, I haven't really taken him in. Normally, I take him in when I go in on the weekends. So he's only seen a few people. One day I accidentally brought him in when it was an evening of fun and games put on by school council. And I walked in and I thought, whoa, why are all these people here? And he was great. He walked up to people and he was like, oh, hi, pet me, pet me. But that's kind of the extent of it. Teaching in a middle school, it's a little bit different. When I'm doing exam week, I'm with the kids. I'm more with the kids, like working with them. Whereas with you, it's more drop being at the high school. So I have to be game on. I can't be checking out.
I'm not checking out. I have kids all the time. But it's a gray area because the kids aren't required to be in my classroom, even though lots of them are in. And Bunsen's definitely a celebrity. So when the word gets out he's in my classroom, the kids come a-running to see Bunsen.
So the next question comes from that same poll on Twitter. Who is Bunsen's favorite human? The long-lasted question. All right, Dad, who do you think it is?
That's a really tough one. I'm more of his boss. I think he really likes me, but I don't think I'm his favorite human. He does get really excited when I come home, and I love that. Our golden that we had before Bunsen, Callan, I loved her to death. She was such a great dog. But when I would come home from work and she'd be like lounging on the couch, I got 3 tail whaps from her. She would look at me, wap her tail 3 times and then go back to sleep or whatever she was doing. But when Adam or Chris came home, Callan would lose her freaking mind and go crazy go nuts to see them. But Bunsen does come to see me. I don't think I'm his favorite human. He really likes Chris and Adam, my father-in-law Gord, and my dad. He really likes my dad too. What do you think, Adam? Who do you think his favorite human is?
I don't know. Even though Mum lost to the raspberries, I think Mum's his favorite human because he hangs out with her on the couch all the time.
Well, I don't know if I'm Bunsen's favorite human, but I do know that I've read up on how to improve your statistics with your dog. how to be the chosen one, and it's the people who spend the most time with him or your dog. So brushing, definitely grooming your dog, the person who feeds the dog, who plays with the dog. So that's kind of a trifecta of things to do to get in their good books.
Yeah, because you brush him more than anybody, and he really likes to get brushed. But I feed him more than you guys, and I take him for giant walks, too. But he still likes you two better than me.
I don't think he likes... No, the jury's out on that.
He's pretty affable. He really likes people. And one of the things we're finding is he really likes little kids, too. Like, he just loves little kids. We had a guest come over with a little guy, and Bunsen just followed him around and tried to be his friend, even though he was really scared of how big Bunsen was. But Bunsen was so super gentle, and he just kept trying to be friends with this little guy. It was really very, very cute.
Well, he's used to Ellie running around, and today we had a baby over, and Bunsen thought that was interesting.
Yeah, I think he probably just wanted to lick the baby.
He didn't, actually, though.
Oh, he didn't lick the baby.
He did not lick the baby.
Okay.
Let me grab the mailbag. That's the last of all the questions for today. And, yeah, thank you for all of the people who voted on the poll on Twitter for this episode. And yeah, that's been the mailbag. See you next time.
And so we've come to the end of this episode's podcast. Thank you so much for listening. And we're going to give a quick shout out to our top tier patrons on our Patreon page who make running this podcast so much easier. Here they are. Thank you so much to Andrea Persons, Bianca Hyde, Chris Hemhold, Elizabeth Bourgeois, Karen Beth St. George, Kathleen Zucher, Dan Rathert, and Liz Button. Thank you so much for supporting the podcast at the top tier level. We're also going to give a quick shout out to Tailblazers in Red Deer. Tailblazers is our local pet supplier. We love them so much, and we're partnering with them to do some social media sharing. My wife was just in Tailblazers today and picked out some really cute, awesome, yummy treats for Bunsen with some help of the knowledgeable staff there that fit in our Furbo. We got this little Furbo thing that spits out treats and we can watch Bunsen during the day. We love it so much. Maybe you've seen some pictures on social media about it. And it's important to get the right weight of the treat and ones that actually aren't too smelly so he's not tempted to go knock it over. So, Tailblazers again, coming through with the needs of your pet. If you're in Central Alberta and near Red Deer, check out Tailblazers. Special thanks this week to our expert, Sam Langford. He made time in his busy schedule to call us from Scotland and talk about science communication. Plus, we just love his accent. It's just awesome. Next week's podcast has an unbelievable guest. His name is Matt Nelson from We Rate Dogs. Even though this episode this week is a 14 out of 10, make sure you tune in next week for a chat with Matt. Let's end with Bunsen's motto. For science, empathy, and cuteness.